Hello, everyone, and welcome to this podcast from the Health Innovation Network, the innovation arm of the NHS. I'm Piers Ricketts, Chief Executive of Health Innovation East.
And I'm Rebecca Cosgriff. I'm the Deputy Director for the Data for Research and Development Programme at NHS England.
Today, we're going to be talking about health data, specifically how current developments in our health data infrastructure can drive forward advances in research, innovation and care. And Rebecca, I thought we could start by reminding listeners of the context. So the single NHS number in England represents potentially the most extensive health data sets in the developed world. And obviously that gives us huge possibilities, potential benefits, both for research and for the public health initiatives that we might want to plan at a local or regional level. And then if we particularly look over recent years, COVID-19 data was really, really important. So apologies perhaps for taking listeners back to that time 3 or 4 years ago. But we had the COVID-19 vaccines research registry, the recovery trial, which gave us dexamethasone, and the COVID-19 pass, all of which depended on the ability to link our data and push information to the right users. But as we've come back to more sort of normal times, I think some of the concerns that patients and public have over privacy and consent, how might my data be used? Many people are perfectly happy for it to be used for research purposes, but worried if it's going to go any further. So some of those concerns have, I think, started to surface, and we're going to talk through some of those in a minute. But before we get into that, three recent policy documents, perhaps for context. So the first one being the NHS England strategy document, Data Saves Lives, from June 2022, which made over 100 commitments to make our health and care system more data-driven for the benefit of patients, clinicians and researchers. And of course, all those things are linked. Then last year, we had the O'Shaughnessy Review of Clinical Trials, which showed that we are in danger of losing what was potentially a market-leading position in the UK in terms of the attractiveness of the UK as a centre for industry to come and recruit patients into trials, and data is at the heart of that. And most recently, the Tony Blair Institute, who a few weeks ago published a paper on harnessing data for health, which proposed the creation of a national data trust, I think with the twin objective of pushing this agenda for our benefit, our health and economic benefits further, but also attempting to safeguard some of the concerns that that people have. So perhaps we can divide the conversation into sort of four. Let's start by discussing some of the current uses of NHS data. Then as we move into sort of research and the challenges, what does the future look like? What does good look like? And then perhaps, talk about some of the concerns and how we think these are being addressed and what people might want to take away. What makes NHS data so important?
I mean, the overview you've just given is really helpful, and I think added to the various strategic directives and documents that you listed, we are waiting with breath that is bated for Cathy Sudlow's unifying UK health data review to be published as well, which I think is going to give some really clear steer about how we can maximise health data from a UK-wide angle as well. But I think it's really clear, and whenever I'm speaking to stakeholders, whether it's patients and the public, NHS colleagues, academia or industry, that the NHS really has a jewel in the crown when it comes to its health data. We have the longitudinal health record, which you've already alluded to, but we also have a really large and diverse patient population, which is something that's really attractive from a research perspective, because it means that we can get representative samples included in answering research questions. That also means that our population can feel increasingly like research represents them, which is something that's really important to us. So that diverse population is really important. We also have access to multimodal data, and the UK has a really globally leading offer when it comes to genomics, and we're certainly looking to make available structured and unstructured data, genomics, digital pathology, imaging and electronic health record data. And if you bring all of those together, you've got something incredibly powerful. Piers, I can see for the people listening, Piers is almost salivating at the thought of getting all of those data sources together. And that's something that I think we can really leverage as a nation if we can make these data sets available in a way that is linked together, which is something that you mentioned we managed to achieve in the pandemic when we had kind of lower barriers to entry because of the urgency needed. And we need to find a way of having robust processes for access that still allow that linkage to happen. Something that I think is spoken about slightly less often in terms of a unique offer from the UK is our connectivity into local clinical teams, which can really support researchers to understand how data have been produced, what clinical care pathway they represent, and how data have or should be curated to best maximise the research that's being conducted. And that's something that we can offer in the NHS that is quite hard to achieve elsewhere because we have our unified health system and clinical teams that in general are research active and have an understanding of the value of data. Last but by no means least, I think our ability to connect in with our local patient populations is also incredibly important, both from the perspective of understanding their lived experience of a particular disease area or a particular intervention that we're trying to understand, but also making sure that there's transparency and awareness of how health data are being used and why and to what ends, so that we really have that trust foundation that we absolutely need if we're going to be able to do really remarkable things when it comes to research.
And I think this is remarkable. So the reason I was smiling sort of a couple of minutes ago when we were talking about genomic data in particular is, you know, listeners, it might be worth reminding, this is technically, or was when we started doing this a few years ago, really hard to achieve because the size of even a single whole genome scan for one person runs into, I mean, you'll know better than me, but it's terabytes or whatever it is. So the idea that you can link that data about a person with imaging data, so, you know, whether it's MRIs or PET scans or whatever it is, plus the other data that sits in the longitudinal record, I think we shouldn't underestimate how really world-leading that has been to achieve. If we think back to the HDR UK Health Data Research Hubs, there were seven of those. So the organisation that I lead, Health Innovation East, did one called Gut Reaction, which was a nice title. It was, I think, 35,000 patients with Crohn's or ulcerative colitis. And we had, as you say, the primary care, secondary care, imaging, and in some cases, genomic data. But of course, the question is, you know, how are we able to use this? How does it link on the one hand into the research, which our amazing clinical scientists throughout our universities and teaching hospitals are doing, and on the one hand, conditions, often long-term conditions, that patients are suffering from, and also, as you say, the diversity of the patient population, because, of course, the disease profile of lots of the different diseases that we're looking into is not uniform across the population. So perhaps, you know, say a little bit more about how we're getting over some of these technical challenges, and then we'll move into, you know, how we're planning to use the data.
Yeah, of course. And I think when it comes to the sheer size of the data that we need to be able to link and make rapidly accessible, there's a number of ways that we're approaching that. And one of them is by designing the structure of one of our investments that we're looking at in the Data for R&D program, which is the NHS Research Secure Data Environment Network. So probably people listening to this podcast might already be aware of what a secure data environment is, or an SDE, but it's a secure analytical layer that provides rapid access to health data without necessarily having to move that data around to provide access. And it means that the researcher comes to the data rather than the data leaving the NHS and moving out to the researcher. Those secure data environments, they're not just a technical stack, they're also an expert data science team complemented by the clinical input that I already mentioned earlier, and they provide the tooling that's required to actually do the analysis on the data once the researchers have access to it. So that's what a secure data environment is. The network, and it very much is a network approach that we're taking, which will bring me back in a second to how we're catering to those really large data sets. Comprises of the NHS England secure data environment on the one hand, which evolved out of the COVID-19 data store that you mentioned at the top in your introduction. But it also includes a small suite of secure data environments that are based out regionally and collectively cover all of England. And that collective coverage is really important because it means that we can be the greater than the sum of our parts, by taking federated data approaches. So by having federated analytic approaches, and federation can mean quite a lot of different things. It's not there's not one size fits all when it comes to federation. But fundamentally what it means is, as well as not having to move data out of the NHS into the hands of researchers, which is something that patients and the public tend to feel less comfortable with, it also means that we're not able to bring back the excellent curation efforts that often happen during that research phase into the NHS to be reused. But it also means that we're moving lots of big data around. And that introduces really significant storage capability requirements that we don't necessarily need. So by providing access to rather than sharing of data, we're already increasing our ability to provide access to these really large data sets, but also by having federated approaches within the NHS Research Secure Data Environment Network, we're able to maximise access to research without having to move it around because we have that federated analytics.
And this is the really clever stuff, isn't it? Because, as you say, the data doesn't move out of this secure cloud infrastructure storage platform, and people come in and run the inquiries on top of it effectively. Is that right?
That's exactly it. We're still searching for the perfect analogy. So yes. If anyone's got suggestions, I'm very willing to hear them. We've tried Data Museum. Because you go into a museum, you view the highly valuable assets, but you don't take them away with you. Well, you shouldn't be doing. If you're taking them away with you, you're doing museums wrong.
Yeah.
Or I think one that often resonates, particularly with our academic community, is we're moving away from a traditional lending library approach, where you take the books away with you,
to a reading
library approach. I'm not sure how many people have been to a reading library sort of in the last decade. So it's not necessarily going to resonate with everybody, but I think that's one way of explaining the difference between a secure data environment approach compared to our traditional data sharing models.
And it's not that long ago. I mean, listeners, I'm sure, will recognise this, but certainly in my time at the Health Innovation Network, where as part of an earlier informatics project, we asked for some patient data, and it arrived in the office in a jiffy bag on a load of DVDs. Now, it was anonymised, but that doesn't really feel right for this stuff to be, move around the country in that way. So this is a huge advance compared with, what researchers previously had to cope with. And certainly in Cambridge, we've been starting some work in federated data, but around genomics, and even within Cambridge University, you have researchers with their own teams with different ways of storing this very large different data sets around genomics. So this is a huge advance, isn't it? And particularly with the protocols that we've got to anonymize or pseudonymize, so that it either can't be linked back to the patient, or it can only be linked back to the patient through a defined set of specific security protocols.
Yeah, and genomics is a huge area of interest for us in the programme, to the extent that we've actually funded a couple of really productive driver projects through the programme, one of which is actually at the University of Cambridge, where we are looking at federated approaches to providing access to data, specifically with the academic use case in mind, where you don't necessarily need the ability to re-identify. So we can get even further removed from the kind of identifiable data, which can be particularly tricky when it comes to genomics. So that's a really exciting piece of work. We've also been partnering with Genomics England, who many people will of course be aware of, who have created the world's largest linked oncology genomics data set. It's got over 6,000 patients in it at the moment. They're aiming for 17,000 over the course of time. And that's going to really support our ability to predict and detect early cancer over time. So that's just a really exciting development. And it's one of the ways that we're exploring how do we optimize these federated approaches, because whilst often people sort of are a little bit glib about the technical stuff is easy, it's the people that are hard. That definitely does ring true, but that I think to say the technical stuff is easy is a little bit of an oversimplification.
Indeed.
I think there are still unanswered questions about which are the best federated data approaches for which data assets and which use cases. And that's something that through the Data for R&D programme and the wider health data ecosystem community, we're looking to find more definitive answers to, so that we can clearly and transparently to communicate to patients as well as our data users how this all works.
Indeed. So if we sort of think about the clinical academic researcher for a moment, what's in it for very eminent clinical scientists pursuing often discoveries at a very kind of small subscale scientific level, whether it's cellular pathology or whatever it is, what's in it for them to participate in some of these big projects that we're talking about and that you envisage being assembled over the coming years?
So as health data users who basically need data to obtain grant funding, answer a scientific hypothesis, and ultimately generate improved care and outcomes for patients, it's a core objective of ours to provide rapid access to linked health data. I think the experience of health data users up until now, whether academic or industry or from medical research charities or indeed from within the NHS, because we obviously have clinical researchers inside the NHS, has been a little bit of a frustrating one, I think, to say the least, where either it can take a long time to access data that you know exists, perhaps it can be challenging to even understand whether the data that you require to answer your research exists and who holds it. gaining the permissions that you require to have that data shared with you, because when data is being shared with you, albeit not on a CD-ROM anymore, even though it's de-identified, the kind of information governance barriers are necessarily quite high when the data is leaving the kind of confines and protections of the NHS. So that introduces time. And I think for academics, that can be especially frustrating because they might be working with PhD researchers or fellows who have a time-limited opportunity to obtain data, curate it, and then hopefully get some analysis done out of it at the other end. So one of the key things they'll get out of kind of participating and engaging with the NHS Research Secure Data Environment Network is ultimately rapid access to the data that they need to do good science. There are other really significant benefits around the fact that we can reuse code, reuse curation, so that every analyst, every PhD student isn't having to start from zero when they are looking to analyse data. And there'll also be harmonised training available across the whole of the SDE network. So if you conduct a project with one secure data environment, priming your research and your data and all of the services around the edges of it, there'll be a harmonised user experience. So it will look very familiar if you're then doing another project in a year's time with a different secure data environment and priming that project. But I mean, I know Piers in the East of England, Mark Avery, who leads the secure data environment that we fund in the East of England, has actually been doing quite a lot of work with the Biomedical Research Centre that's based there. Yeah. So I'm actually really interested in your experience of working closely with the Biomedical Research Centre, because I think that's something that we'd be really excited to do more systematically across the whole of the NHS Research SDE network. So the academic kind of NIHR funded assets like the BRCs and the ARCs feel that there is a tangible value return to them for engaging in the SDE network. So I'm kind of curious to hear more about your experience there.
Yeah, sure. So we're incredibly fortunate to be able to work with Cambridge University, one of the country's leading, in fact, world leading areas of clinical and scientific research. And I think where it's worked particularly well has been that, you know, what your team is doing is finding an infrastructure platform that will help particular researchers in their own area of focus. So we talked about genomics a couple of times earlier. Genomics, sequencing started in Cambridge with Sanger all those years ago, and is still a very important area of research. So in the years before the SDE, Mark and the team did a couple of projects where they were able to, as we said earlier, I think, you know, federate genomic data into a single cloud-based source. And I think what you've got to be able to demonstrate to attract researchers in is what you were talking about earlier, which is the scientific utility of having their data in this secure and curated environment. Clearly, as NHS England, you're ultimately interested in patient benefits in terms of our understanding of diseases and our ability to treat them. But for researchers, it's being able to say, how will this be interesting to me as an academic researcher to have my data curated in this way? And we're very proud of the relationships that we've got with Cambridge, as you say, with the BRC, with the BioResource, with whom we worked on a couple of these earlier projects, and we very much hope that will continue. And I think for each of our major clinical scientific areas up and down the country, and I've worked quite a lot in Manchester and Liverpool, for example, has different areas of clinical expertise. So Cambridge, it might be genomics. It's using genomics, particularly for the application of early diagnosis of cancer and for some of the rarer cancers, and as we move towards personalized medicine. Liverpool, had very, very well-known expertise in tropical medicine through the School of Tropical Medicine, for example. Manchester, all sorts of things, a proud moment, when was it? Probably 8 or 9 years ago with the Salford Lung Study, where the first time using the shared care record almost in sort of real life, to enable research to happen in and for patients to pull out of a trial or be added to the trial in real time. So I think it's a question of, as I say, we've really enjoyed the work we do in Cambridge, and it's a question of finding the things that are particularly applicable to each of our centres of excellence that they might want to collaborate with us on.
Yeah, I think that's really good advice. And over the next financial year and beyond, the secure data environments in the network will be hosting kind of joined up conversations with the BRCs and the ARCs to really explore how they can best support the NIHR infrastructure that's kind of on their patch. And it's very much our hope that designing the secure data environment teams from the very outset to have translation from research into practice baked in, by having them as formal partnerships between academic institutions and NHS organisations, is something that will make that reasonably organic, with a bit of kind of central coordination from the team at NHS England. But I think you've mentioned something really important around the need for health data users, whether academic or industry, to understand where can they find the expertise that they require to address their particular research question, whether it's in rare diseases, cardiovascular cancer, whatever it might be, or expertise in a particular modality, whether that's imaging or genomics, for example. And one of the ways that we're addressing that is by having the centrally coordinated network with distributed delivery for research, which is so that we can have through the NHS England SDE the real breadth of national scale data, and then through our regional secure data environments, the depth required, particularly with access to multimodal data and that connection into local communities. But really our hope is that from a research perspective, you don't have to worry about that.
Yeah.
What you can do is go through the Health Data Research UK's Health Data Gateway, which will be the single front door for the NHS Research SDE network. Describe what your research project is, describe what data you require, and essentially have an indication at that point about which SDE is best placed to prime your project.
You might require,
and I've already mentioned Federation, you might require data from multiple SDEs, but there will be one that is best suited to provide the expertise needed to bring that data together through federated approaches and make it accessible rapidly, which data access committee you need to go through, for example. So that will be an option for researchers to go through a single route if they don't know where to start. If there's an established relationship with a secure data environment like the East of England, for example, they can still get on the phone, speak to Mark Avery and discuss how to start their journey that way. But for an academic that maybe doesn't have that familiarity with the ecosystem, it's sort of my bread and butter, so I know it fairly well, but for lots it's not, or if it's their first research project using NHS data, for example, the Health Data Gateway will be that single portal that harmonises the whole ecosystem.
So a single front door to this world, that sounds an amazing concept. Because you can also imagine where, if we're looking at rare diseases, the population profile in a particular SDE area might not be large enough for the data that a researcher will need to look at a rare disease. So you might want data from people from the East of England, from Manchester and Cornwall, for example, and I'm assuming that would be possible in time, if there's a curation through the single front door.
Yeah, exactly. And you know, it's a journey.
Yes.
There are really amazing examples of research happening within the SDE network right now. For example, in the London SDE, there's been a really nice project that has enabled implementation of an AI-enabled stethoscope. That's been deployed in over 200 GP practices and is projected to save the NHS £100 million. So that's just one example in one of our secure data environments. So good stuff is happening already. But it's really important, I think, that we're upfront with the system, with health data users and with patients and the public, that this is a journey that we're on.
Yes.
The health data ecosystem is fragmented for a number of reasons. And in many ways, we're trying to fix what has been broken up to now.
Yeah.
And that takes time and investment. So that full federation, that kind of holy grail that we're aiming at, is going to take some time. We're getting there as fast as we can, but we're going to get there incrementally and driven by projects that are of the greatest need for the NHS, because ultimately that's my job is to deliver benefits to the NHS and patients. So very much it will be incremental, and we're testing it out with driver projects. For example, we're working with Prostate Cancer Research on a program called Prostate Progress.
Okay.
And that's establishing something that I would describe as almost a virtual registry. And it really capitalizes on the expertise of a medical research charity on the one hand, which can connect directly in with their beneficiaries, their patients, to understand their needs, gather experience and outcomes data directly from patients that's kind of owned by them. And that's something they would explicitly consent into. But that can be backed up with the routinely generated data that comes from the NHS, again, with consent and full transparency to the patients involved, so that we're not double collecting information that can be surfaced and provided by the NHS. So that's an example of a federated driver project that we're kind of just getting off the ground, and we're going to seek to expand and scale that across the network over time.
And I think there's a parallel there with our own health innovation network. You know, we are 15 organisations who together belong to a network, but in neither of these cases would it have been right to set up one entity, so like a head office with 15 regional offices, or a head office SDE with subsidiaries in each of the regions, because all of these depend on an understanding of local relationships. You know, in our case, what we do is clinical transformation, often or operational transformation, and you can only do that, as my old boss Mark Britton used to say, change is a human contact sport and the currency is people. Equally, what you're starting with, the main assets are locally driven, highly detailed research, undertaken by individual universities or teams of clinical academics. So I think it's very important to stress that's probably why in both cases we've taken the kind of architecture approach that we have. You can't do it top down, right?
And we're not in a situation where one size fits all.
Yes.
You know, NHS data that we kind of started at the top of this podcast with, what are the unique selling points of NHS data and why is it valuable? And part of its value is the fact that it is complex. It's necessarily complex. If we oversimplify the data itself to try and get to a simple sounding architectural solution, then we undermine the value of exactly what we're trying to provision access to. And I think that's something that we really need to bear in mind, but also that there isn't one size fits all when it comes to satisfying different research use cases. So you mentioned rare diseases. Exactly as you say, that might require access to multiple regional secure data environments through federated approaches, for example, or it might be that to answer your research question in rare diseases, that actually approaching the NHS England secure data environment, which has national access, or going through the NHS DigiTrials service, which is also a national service funded by the Data for R&D programme, if you're looking to conduct a clinical trial or do feasibility for a study, might be the best approach. And again, what we're really trying to do and centrally coordinate in the programme is sort of take that mental load of that decision-making off of the researchers. So you can just tell us as a collective what it is you need, and we can tell you where in the ecosystem is best placed to satisfy your request, whilst not creating any kind of bottleneck that means a lot of researchers wanting to do, for example, rare disease research have to sit in a fairly long queue, because it's my job to make sure we can do as much valuable research as possible. And that requires us to leverage whole system capacity and all of the expertise that exists out there in the regions, which is kind of money can't buy expertise. If I was trying to directly employ all of the people that I have the privilege of being able to work with, my budget would have to be considerably bigger, but I'm able to leverage with, actually in the grand scheme of things, a relatively small investment, data science expertise that's very well respected globally across all of England.
Thank you. And I'm sure listeners can hear that we're both, for different reasons, you know, really excited by these developments. But perhaps we should talk a little bit about public trust and how we can bring people with us. So there's a whole history of episodes over the last 10 years where the public often will understand that the use of their data for the common good, for the wider good in terms of disease treatment and so on, is absolutely necessary. But there are often perceptions that, well, will my data be used for something else? Is it going to be sold for third-party benefit? How can we, what are some of the safeguards, and how can we build public trust and bring people with us as this data gets bigger and the uses for which we need it become ever more important?
Yeah, and there are a lot of ways that we need to and are approaching this. I think there's always more that we can do. Fundamentally, the Data for R&D programme is designed with public trust baked in. Mm-hmm. So we're not creating new flows of data. We're improving processes that already happen by moving away from data sharing towards data access. So it's very much our hope that as a public trust initiative, that we are coming from a good place of then being able to have a meaningful conversation with patients and the public, because we're not having to kind of excuse or apologise for what we're doing. I think we can actually convey the enthusiasm that, yes, that people are hearing from you and I to patients and the public. And we're doing that through a number of different routes. One of those is the Data for R&D programme is funding a large scale public deliberative series of events that are taking place more or less right now,
so over
this summer and beyond. And they are to tackle holistically questions that patients and the public have already told us through previous work are important to them. So rather than me leading a conversation about the Data for R&D programme, which is not necessarily super meaningful as a concept to patients and the public, we're starting with the patient and how they feel about themselves and their data and shaping conversations on that basis. So we're talking about opt-out, for example. That's one of the conversations that we're having. Public expectations of transparency around data and public expectations when it comes to commercial access to and uses of NHS data, and how we return fair value back on uses of data to the NHS. So it was a really great opportunity for us to explain that data don't leave the NHS through this new model, yeah. So there's no selling of data, but we appropriately charge for services around data provisioning, whether that's providing platforms for data analysis or provisioning data, precisely. So we were able to have a really honest conversation. And what's been really nice, I think, about those deliberative events is they are a forethought, not an afterthought. So we've been able to have those conversations with jeopardy. If patients and the public tell us that they want something or do not want something, it's kind of beholden upon me and my colleagues to respect that and find a way to incorporate it into what we do, or have a very, very good explanation for why we're having to go down another route or have explored another option. So it's been a real privilege to be involved in those public deliberations. They're being led by my colleagues at the Department of Health. And we're really excited to see the outputs of those and how we can incorporate them into the design of what we're trying to achieve. So that's just one way that we're looking at patient and public involvement and engagement. But I'm also really lucky that I can stand on the shoulders of giants in terms of the patient and public involvement and engagement activities that are happening in the regional secure data environments. So it's part of our agreement with all SDEs in the network that they'll conduct their own patient and public engagement and involvement activities, again, with Jeopardy. So they can have that really meaningfully locally connected conversation where patients and the public can speak to clinical teams who actually work in their area, actually know their patch. And that's something that's really important to us. And there's a lot of very good examples. I was speaking yesterday to Ben Bridgewater, who works in the Manchester area, and they've done some really nice engagement activities and communications activities, being really transparent with patients and the public about what happens to their data for research purposes and why. And I know in the East of England that there's been conversations that have been supported by Health Watch, for example. Yes. So Mark Avery's been telling me a little bit about that. So that activity is happening all across the network that we're able to kind of synthesize and build upon. We're also, I'll say this as a last one, and then okay. Piers, if you want to prompt me for more, I'm happy to give more. But we're really delighted to be a funding partner for the organization Understanding Patient Data.
Okay.
I think there are some conversations that it's right and proper to be had directly from the NHS. There's some that should be led by the Department of Health as the policymaker. I think there's some conversations where it's really helpful for them to be conducted by an organisation that's a little bit independent of the system and can give us advice and recommendations that we need to take on board. And Understanding Patient Data, which is led by Nicola Hamilton, is a really good partner to the wider health data ecosystem, where they offer challenge where it's needed and they offer support where that's required. So we co-fund them, but their work is very much conducted independently. And a recent project that they've just published on is called What Words to Use, which I think is just a really nice name for a project. Yeah. Because I don't need to explain it any further, really. It does what it says on the tin, and it lets us know, as sometimes slightly technocratic professionals working in the system, what words we should use when we're talking about use of health data in a way that's meaningful to patients and the public. Being open and transparent about the benefits, and also open and transparent about the disbenefits as well, because nothing's easy, nothing's perfect, and we shouldn't patronise the public by trying to pretend that everything's easy, everything's rosy, and everything's going to be super quick, because some things take time.
And I think on that score, when I last looked, I think about 5% of patients had opted out in primary care for their data to be used for research purposes. So 5% is significant, but it's still a relatively small number given the aspirations that we've got. And I guess the other sort of thing to mention there, going back to the East of England, when Mark and the team built Gut Reaction, the input of Crohn's and Colitis UK, these are long-term conditions for which there is really only mitigation, there's no treatment, was absolutely fundamental, not just in terms of the acceptance of our getting the patient data to put into the hub, but actually shaping it and understanding why it was necessary and why this data was necessary. And we were really incredibly inspired by the willingness of patients whom the charity brought to us to participate in the design and the build of that hub. So as you say, there are ways of working and co-creating with patients.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, my background before this role, I worked in the Cystic Fibrosis Trust and kind of looked after the data strategy there. And that's a community that, for cross-infection reasons, can't actually come together face-to-face. So they had a whole campaign after the kind of peak of the COVID-19 pandemic around the fact that they were coughing before it went viral, which I've always thought was quite clever. That was, I think, something that was very easy to see as a barrier to involving patients in decision-making, because we couldn't bring them all together in the same room and have a workshop with them. But it just meant that we had to think of other ways, you know, digital solutions to bring people together and to meaningfully engage them. So even where there are challenges specific to a particular condition, whether it's a cohort that's hard to identify, a particular medical condition that's maybe not so much part of someone's identity that they really want to put it at the forefront, or something like cystic fibrosis where cross-infection is an issue, there's always a way around it, and actually working with patients and the public on how we should engage them is also a really important part of the process.
Absolutely. I think we're getting towards time there. So this is very exciting. We've talked about why data is so important, the incredible advances that we can make by harnessing research into the world-leading research that we have in the UK with our clinical scientists into areas like genomics and cancers and so on, with what we're now able to do with data infrastructure and architecture, so we can actually put all this data together in a way that we couldn't before, but with these security protocols that we've talked about. And we've also talked about how we're able to address some of the very entirely understandable patient and public concerns over how this data might be being used. So really, really exciting, lots to look forward to. I wonder if you had any final thoughts before we wrap.
Just mostly that it's been a real pleasure to be able to talk about the programme in this level of detail. It's not something I always get the opportunity to do. And really, we are incredibly excited about the future. I've mentioned a few times that these things take time, but every time I speak to one of our leads of our secure data environments, whether that's the NHS England secure data environment team or one of the regional ones, they've all got a number of new, incredibly exciting research projects in the pipeline. And so I can't wait to maybe have a conversation with you and future peers about where we've got up to and what new research and patient impact we're delivering, because I think we're headed towards having a real tidal wave of exciting projects that we can really shout about from the rooftops, which I also hope will further galvanise the patient and public to really get behind this idea of research being powered by data from the NHS.
Thank you very much. Well, we're recording this at NHS Confed Expo, June 2024, so maybe same time next year or the year after that.
Sounds good.
Rebecca, thank you very much. It's been a pleasure.
Thanks, Piers.